All right, welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and today I'm excited to bring an issue that I think is really sort of the nitty-gritty of being a professor, being in academia. So a lot of you in higher ed will sort of nod your head along to these things, and some of you who maybe aren't in higher ed or aren't in academia will kind of learn a lot about sort of the behind-the-scene things on a global level. So this is the SSCI syndrome in higher education, a local or global phenomenon. And this is from a series in Competitive and International Education, a diversity of voices from Since Publishers. And this was published in 2014. And today I'm excited to bring on the editor of this book, Chewing Prudence Zhou, from the Chungchi University in Taiwan. Dr. Zhou, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good, very good. Thank you all the way from Taiwan, and I'm here in New York, so I appreciate you making the time, because it's so late there.
My pleasure. Yeah, it's late. My pleasure.
If we could, let's maybe hop into your background. Can you kind of tell us your background, how you got into education, your path brought you here to where you're at now?
Yes, I've been always interested in education, especially when I was doing my PhD in comparative ed and international education from UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, long time ago. And the motivation for me to go there late 80s was to learn more about China. You know, that during that period of time, we still had martial law. Mm. And it's a forbidden topic about China in Taiwan. So I went to U.S. instead to pursue my professional training there.
Right.
And after that, I ended up in the China studies in education tend to be part of the comparative ed circle. So I spent a couple of years there and then returned to Taiwan and started working on China from international perspective. So that's how I landed as a China hand, so to speak, in education in Taiwan.
Mm. Okay, absolutely. And a lot of experience there, which I think informs this book considerably. Maybe we can kind of talk about how this came together and sort of your connection with the comparative international education. Oh, go ahead.
Yes. And as you all know that in East Asian region, especially when we talk about, for example, education in China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Macau, even in Korea, Japan, or Singapore, you always come across with the idea that these regions have something in common, the Confucius heritage.
Right.
For example, family value on education. And also, education has been considered a first priority, not only for the child or child, but also for the family. So it's a family thing, it's a cultural thing that you have to do well. And so is in academia. When if you are in academia, you are considered, in a very high profile, in a very respected social status, so to speak. So that's why it's good that everybody value education a lot. Parents put that efforts on children's education, making sacrifices to help children out. In school. But on the other hand, ranking becomes a serious issue. When you say ranking, we mean competition in your grades, competition in succeeding to a better school, in high school, in universities. Even today, at a university, unfortunately, because ranking, especially the issue of the world-class university ranking, picks up all the competition and regardless of any social differences, any different academic disciplines. Nowadays, the government, especially in these countries, spend so much effort and investment pushing university into the world class.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, many faculty members, especially in China, as I mentioned, those receiving countries, the academic faculty members now are evaluated based on their publication.
Right.
Especially publication for international journals. And I don't blame this trend because in sciences, in natural sciences, in engineering, in medical sciences, I mean, that discipline has been always considering publication in international journal as the priority. It's been there for many, many years. When you talk to faculty members in social sciences and humanities, they are very much cultural bound. And many faculty members in these disciplines focus so much on local issues. Because of that, because I think everybody knows that, for example, education, not only in Taiwan, but also even at Harvard, Harvard University School of Education focus very much on domestic issues only.
Right.
With English as the major language. So as in many other parts of the world. So I think that in Taiwan, especially we as the faculty member in education field, we always focus on our local issue, how to deal with education problems, how to come up with education innovation in the classroom, and so on and so on. So we use lots of language, such as the Chinese, of course, as our major communication language. And we talk to our teachers, local teachers, in the local context. But because of that trend, as I mentioned, nowadays the many, many faculty members are required to publish more English journal articles, especially in those so-called SSCI, the Social Science Citation Index,
right,
which used to be a library database for, you know, references. But nowadays they are becoming the high stake criteria for publication,
mm-hmm,
regardless of any discipline.
Right.
That's why that triggered my motivation, my inspiration, or my interest in editing book of such the SSCI syndrome. I created this term myself. The reason, because the syndrome now is becoming widespread. It's becoming rampant all over the world, especially the non-English speaking world. Mm-hmm. You can tell not only in Taiwan but also East Asia, of course, Singapore, China, Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, but also in, for example, Iran or in Mexico or even in some other you name it, some countries, some states in the Middle East. You can tell that more and more pressure on pushing faculty members in social sciences and humanities.
Right.
On this
have you talked at various conferences and things like that? Have people responded to this and told you, like, yes, it's the same problem we're having in our
Yes. Like the East European colleagues last year when I was having a conference in Athens, and they talked about this one. And faculty members from Mexico, they discussed it. This issue, so it's unfortunately it's more like a worldwide issue that social scientists and humanity experts are facing,
mm-hmm,
very much the same dilemma.
Right,
we were caught in between, First, we need to take care of our local issues. We have to come up with something helpful, useful to our local needs, because we are using public money,
right,
public spending,
right,
on education. But on the other hand, we have to correspond to the world issue and sometimes accommodate or compromise our research topics into the so-called mainstream English journals.
Yeah.
We have to appeal. We have to come up with some topics that would interest the mainstream editor in chief, so that our papers would be accepted for publication.
Right.
So it's more like a dilemma. It's really tough for us.
Right.
Yeah.
Can we maybe jump into the SSCI a little bit more? You mentioned it started out as sort of a library listing. Can you maybe talk about that a little bit more and how it grew into this?
Go ahead. The SSCI is the abbreviation of science. There are a few abbreviations. SCI, Science Citation Index.
Mm-hmm.
SSCI stands for Social Science Citation Index. Also another one, ANHCI, the Arts and Humanities Citation Index.
Mm.
And also another EI, Engineering Citation Index, Engineering Index, something like that. All of them are run by the Thomson Reuters company.
Right.
And it is a profit-driven organization. Means these database, they charge each university or the library to a great expense.
Right.
Millions of dollars. So that's why we said they used to be for library reference only. I think it's okay. But nowadays they become the criteria, the major criteria for publication. For example, if you try to publish your article here, you search whether this article, this journal, belongs to the SSCI database.
Right.
If it's collected in those databases, you are safe, you submit. If they are not, and then they are considered secondary or, low profile, not very good. Or you may put it in this way. Last Friday, when I was in a international conference in Taiwan, some colleagues from overseas mentioned, after this conference, we should come up with some article to be published in some good journals. So he meant there are some good journals and some bad journals.
Right.
And we should always go for good journals. So I protested. That's his talk. I said, well, when you say good journals, you mean SSCI only? What about, we have so many other journals, and especially they are not for profit. They have public access.
Right.
And they are not making any money out of it. They are just for the common good. So we can share, for the circulation, free circulation of information, just like what you are doing now.
Yeah.
So I guess, when you consider, you classify them into the good and the bad. So the consequences are, for those so-called good or high-cited or those SSCI journals, they have too many papers on the waiting list.
Mm.
They are very competitive, and
right.
I don't want to say their quality must be better than the others. I am not sure, because there's no evidence to show. I know most of the journals have peer review.
Right.
Even with the peer review process, there must be something behind the scene, some hidden rule that you have to know, you have to play the rule of game.
Right.
Or something. You know the rule, you know the etiquette, you know the topic, you know their interest, something like that. So, I mean, it's still biased in a way. But when you say good and bad journals, you mean you are reproducing a very capitalistic idea in academia that you help those highly competitive journals,
right,
to be in a situation that sometimes I have to say they become very arrogant in a way.
I see.
Because they are highly in demand. On the other hand, many, many non-SSCI, non-SCI journals, they are short of submission.
Right.
And especially in the local, what I'm seeing here, the local non-TSSCI. We also come in Taiwan, we also come up with a Taiwanese social science citation index we call TSSCI.
Mm.
For those non-TSCI journals, they are running out of paper submission.
Right.
So that creates a very unequal profile between the highly in demand journal and those who are not.
Right.
I don't think that's the main, that's the essence, that's the real meaning for our work.
Right. Right. And so this is all connected back to this idea of world-class universities.
Mm-hmm.
So can you kind of talk about how exactly the SSCI connects to these rankings and what
these I think the origin of the issue partly was because of the neoliberal principle, you know,
right,
the market ring, the competition will, you know, the accountability for the university.
Right.
So and so. That part of the reason behind this whole SSCI syndrome. And apart from that, the world-class university ranking benchmark started 2003. First initiated by Shanghai Jiao Tong University in China. They come up with some ideas, some scheme about comparing universities with their own scale, with their own categories. For example, how many Nobel Prize winners,
right,
the university could recruit, and how many papers in those, you know, SSCI, SCI, and how many the ratio between students and faculty members, and how many foreign or international students and faculty members on campus.
Right.
So on and so on. But these type of rankings focus so much on publication, research only, especially for, as I said, the number and also the number count. First, the number of publication. Second, the citation, and then the impact factor.
Right.
So all sorts of ranking all the universities worldwide with a very pseudo, I should say, it's a fake objective criteria.
Right, the measurement.
The measurement based on those numbers, those figures, quantitative figures. So you tend to see that the top 100 universities or 200 universities, who are they?
Right, they're all Western or American.
Western, English-speaking, and comprehensive university.
Right.
For example, Harvard. What about For example, the French ministers of education always complained and protested over and over again to China that they urged Chinese government shouldn't let these kind of Jiao Tong University or ranking competition win or sometimes overshadow others, for example, French.
Right.
French universities are very, none of them, or very, very few of them have been given fair measurement.
Right.
The reason, because the French university, according to my Chinese colleagues who mentioned they conduct some interviews with those French universities, and then they realize most of the French universities are not comprehensive universities. They are classified, they are grouped into different functions based on, for example, the university of A university probably is good, it's the mission, the major mission is for teaching instruction for the majority of the students. The type B university is for research only. That's the research institute.
Right.
For research publication only. And the third one is only for professional schools and masters and PhDs. So they have very specific functions of their university and research institutes. They are not like American universities. One size fits all.
Right.
Combining all the research, teaching, and community services. So you can tell that it's a very relative, it's a very unfair and also very superficial comparison. How could university be compared?
Right. Go ahead.
They are not based on the same level.
Mm-hmm.
They are not on the equal footing at all. University of Harvard, how much the endowment? Harvard can be as rich as any small or medium-sized country.
Right. Very
so true. It's unfair to, you know, to do those ranking, ranking scheme.
Right.
It's nonsense. But the legislature, Congress, even the government, they buy it because they rank the universities so the university can be simplified based on the measurement.
Right.
So everybody knows, you know, this university is the top 100, top 200, something like that. But I think that's not the nature of the university. That make the university to compete without appropriate resources.
Right.
Or sometimes force the universities to take the shortcut. For example, to drive their faculty members to publish more, to meet the criteria for the ranking purpose. It's not for the university, not for the higher education purpose. The mission is no longer is distorted by this ranking result.
Right. And I mean, I think you hit it on the head with this idea of competition, which I think maybe it's very normal for an American context, potentially, but outside of the U.S., maybe there isn't an expectation that higher education institutions are fighting with each other. But with these rankings and the SSCI, that's become the sort of new reality in higher education globally.
It also changed the collegiality within the institute. Nowadays, especially for those untenured or junior faculty members, they are at the stage of publish or perish.
Yeah, right.
Place, which not only created lots of pressure on their survival, but also, taking lots of time, or, you know, how do I say, taking lots of their time away from teaching.
Right.
Yeah, because the research and publication now are considered the top priority in teaching. You know, there's no teaching competition worldwide. You know, the world class university ranking, nobody said, you know, how good your teaching quality is.
Right. Right.
It's not a measurement. It's not a criteria at all. So that's teaching now in many so-called top research universities. Teaching nowadays is considered secondary.
Right.
And which is terrible.
Right. I think you kind of wrap the book up with your chapter as a question, and you says, has higher education lost its soul?
Yes.
Can you maybe talk about what that question means and the search for that answer?
As you just mentioned, universities, especially higher education systems, very different from the American model. In America, you have so many private institutes that are based on profit organization, that are run by some company or even by some private sectors that can be for profit. But whereas outside of the U.S., I did some international comparison, and I realized that most of, I don't want to say 100, but maybe the majority, a great majority of universities outside of the America are government run,
right?
Mostly, just like the one in Canada, or even in UK, mm-hmm. in France, in Germany, even in China. We have so many universities that are run or monitored by university, by government. So that there are so many missions to be fulfilled, and education is only just one of them. I have to say that most of the universities in the world outside of U.S. are public or are considered public goods. Even public universities are considered the majority in a country. So that we have to fulfill the mission to educate the next generation. So education purpose, teaching responsibility are very, very important, even priority for us. And research is, we have to adapt research in order to improve our teaching. Research is, should be as equal as teaching mission. And then community service, especially for faculty members in social sciences and humanities, we always have to conduct research relevant to our local needs. We call social relevancy. So that's why if universities, the top priority are for the fulfillment of public goods, we should keep in mind that education should keep itself for the betterment of others, for the betterment of our next generation, for right. the improvement of our society.
Absolutely.
That's the goal for the university, you know, especially the origin of that mission.
Right.
But because of this SSCI and World Class University rank, now I have to say we are forced to conduct something that alienated or something that
unnatural things?
Unnatural, drift us apart from our original goal. For example, more and more faculty members are becoming very, very selfish.
Mm.
I have to say, altruism is the beauty of collegiality. It used to be the beauty among faculty members. We share, exchange our ideas about research. But because of the competition for publication now, many, many people, they use they publish papers out of very, very short period of time because the number counts. So you couldn't really share with others because you're afraid someone might steal your ideas, your originality, something
right.
like that.
Right.
So they become, family members become very, very narrow. And for those who have good network, they can reproduce their work so quickly because of the networking. So it's not only people become very selfish, but also,
uncooperative or
something.
Okay.
Well, collaboration depends on if you are on the right track, you probably you can cooperate with many others. But if you are not on the right track, for example, if you couldn't get approved of your research funding, probably you are out.
Right.
So it's a very unhealthy and unnatural climate,
okay.
academic culture.
Right.
That we have.
I haven't been in academia that long, or I'm moving there. I'm not even there, but I can already see or sort of recognize that that's out there, which I think you're right. Isn't really a healthy environment or climate for innovation and different ways of thinking. If you could maybe, go ahead.
So that's why I think we have to pay more attention to this issue about the unhealthy or the unnatural world-ranking university. We have to bring this issue out that it's so many side effects and who really benefit from those syndromes, SSCI syndrome,
right.
or world-class university ranking. We have to point this out to our general public and to warn our academia and warn our government.
Right.
This is not the only choice that they should follow.
Right. Okay. Well, any final words on this book that you want our audience to maybe know or recognize?
There are not many. Although the issue has been attracting many attentions worldwide, the conference I went to all received very similar sentiments about this issue. The whole SSCI issue. Not necessarily using this name, but the published parish and the world-class university link.
Right.
We all know the side effect. We all know there's something wrong with this system. But only there now we are still lacking collective action, even collective research, a series of research in this regard that was more empirical data to show what kind of side effects, or even to argue what good and bad about the system and how we can improve. If something came out from this competition, we should say it. But what about the downside? How can we avoid, how can we improve that downside? Especially for those who still struggle in social sciences and humanities, for those who are still very junior, very vulnerable to the system, how can we help them out? How can we bring back our, academic soul?
Right. Okay, well, I encourage everyone to check out the SSCI Syndrome in Higher Education, a Local or Global Phenomenon. Dr. Jode, a final question for the New Books Network. Can you maybe talk about what's next? I understand you have another book project upcoming, but or anything else you want to share with us?
Yeah, I have two new books in progress. The first one is the Chinese Models of Education from Diverse Society that I try to, because of the rise of China, and we try to examine whether there's something in common across the globe that the Chinese societies, not only in China, but also outside of China, in the U.S., in the U.K., or even in Taiwan, if there's anything in common, that how education heritage has been carried on. And this is also inspired by the Tiger Mom.
Right.
That book,
Amy Chua, yeah.
And we'd like to give some alternative viewpoint about her book. And so, to see whether there's any models of Chinese education or not.
Right.
So this is my new book. Hopefully will be published the end of the year or early next year, 2016. And another book right now I'm still thinking about that one. It's the Taiwanese higher education model of the Taiwanese higher education model. As I mentioned, it's unfair to compare orange and apple, with the same measurement.
Right.
And I have to say that Taiwanese education model deserves some attention because, for example, our tuition is quite expensive. And we run the university with a very high cost, cost efficient way. Mm. We have we have more than 160 universities out of 23 million population in Taiwan. And we also attract lots of international students, especially students from China, that who enjoy with very low tuition, I have to say, but with good quality. So the next stage, I would try to investigate some models of Taiwanese high end and to see, hopefully, that would set some example for some other neighboring country or some medium-sized countries that can take into it as reference how to run good university with a limited budget. That's probably the subtitle book.
Okay. Well, we look forward to both of those, and potentially I can have you back on for a chat about that, because that's certainly an interesting area for me and I think a lot of our listeners as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. So I just thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Prudence Zhou, for joining me today. And I encourage everyone to check out the book, The SSI Syndrome in Higher Education, A Local or Global Phenomenon. And to all the listeners out there, I hope you learned.